Okay, I can't tell if those are boos or if those are... So, don't answer. You don't have to answer.
Senator Dan Sullivan meets with a very vocal crowd at an Anchorage town hall meeting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, May 22nd. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, people in Anchorage rally against cuts to the education budget proposed by the state Senate.
We will not tolerate cuts to public education, and we would like you to create fiscal certainty with long-term fiscal plan.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan held a town hall meeting in Anchorage on Saturday, one of only a few he's held on the road system since the election of President Donald Trump. Hundreds packed into Bartlett High School auditorium, and as Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports, they were frequently vocal.
This was not the kind of crowd Sullivan is used to.
Okay, I can't tell if those are boos or if those are... Don't answer. You don't have to answer that.
When he spoke about rolling back federal regulation and turning control over to the states, lines that usually draw applause for him fell flat, or worse.
The states who understand their market much better than bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. design a program that...
Sullivan took questions for over an hour. Many were about proposed changes to the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare worker Sarah Stevens asked the senator how he expects Alaskans to bear the cost of giving birth if Congress allows insurers to drop maternity coverage.
Pregnancies. What I don't support is a federal government plan like you have under the Affordable Care Act that says to a 60-year-old male, you have to have insurance that covers maternity. It makes no sense, and that's why you have premiums spiking.
But isn't that just health insurance? I don't need prostate exams, but I pay into a health care plan.
The crowd frequently booed and held up red cards to show their disagreement.
But just to get it out in the system and get the biggest boo of the night, I am not supporting a single-payer health system.
Red cards also went up when Sullivan spoke of defunding Planned Parenthood and mentioned any of Trump's more controversial cabinet secretaries. Green cards appeared when Sullivan described Russia as an adversary and said Alaska's climate is changing. The crowd chanted yes or no when Sullivan did not give a simple answer to a question about his support for expanded Medicaid. The senator says he's focused on not pulling the rug out from current enrollees. Donna Marie is among the constituents who have been clamoring for months for a congressional town hall in Anchorage. At his request, she introduced Sullivan on the Bartlett stage, and she took it on herself to ask people to be respectful and avoid booing. She says it surprised her how one-sided the audience was.
I thought that the senator would have more conservative support in the crowd and more support for his views, but I didn't see more than three or four what I would call Trump administration supporters, and the rest of the crowd seemed overwhelmingly progressive.
Marie says Sullivan seemed to respond with good grace and humor, and she says it's understandable passions ran high among the audience.
Were they rude? Perhaps a little bit, but they weren't out of control, and it's not like they prevented the meeting from going on. There were, they might have delayed for a couple of moments, but otherwise I thought that the audience reacted appropriately given the situation.
Marie says she's hoping Senator Lisa Murkowski or Congressman Don Young will appear at a town hall she's organizing at the end of the month. With help from Zachariah Hughes, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Sullivan, in a written statement today, said the Anchorage town hall was more raucous than his previous community outreach events, but he says he believes in listening to all Alaskans, regardless of party or ideology. More than 100 people gathered in Anchorage's Cuddy Midtown Park on Saturday, urging lawmakers to support public education funding. The Senate is proposing a $65 million cut to education, while the House wants a slight increase. Alaska Public Media's Josh Edge reports.
The crowd, many clad in rain jackets, braved a cool, overcast Saturday morning and listened to local business leaders like Anchorage Community Development Authority head Andrew Halcrow emphasize the importance of public education to Alaska businesses.
Over 92% of the students in this state go to public schools. That's 92% of the workforce. That's 92% of the people who graduate and go out into the marketplace and come into my business and apply for a job.
The rally focused on urging lawmakers to support a sustainable fiscal plan, preserving education funding well into the future. Dina Mitchell is with Great Alaska Schools, the organization that put on the event.
Alaska needs a culture of education. From pre-K through university system, we need a strong educational system for current businesses to be able to recruit employees, from IT people graduating from university to high school graduates going straight into the workplace, and also for future innovation. It's so important.
While a series of speeches kicked off the rally, the main event was opportunities for those attending to immediately appeal to lawmakers, specifically those in the Senate majority who are proposing a 5% cut to education to make up a portion of the state's $2.5 billion budget gap.
I'm Jillian. How do I fill out one of these?
Sure. We have a postcard for the House of Representatives, okay, thanking them for their bipartisan leadership. And we have a postcard for key senators asking them to please support public education.
Okay, so I should write to my senator.
Yep.
Okay.
Jillian Inglis has deep ties to public education in the state. She's a product of Alaska's public school system, as are her daughters. And she says she has family members who work in public schools. She's addressing a postcard to Senator Kevin Meyer, an Anchorage Republican, because she's concerned about the effects of continued cuts.
Well, it has an impact on class size, the number of teachers that we have, and the ability to educate our kids properly. That's the impact.
Postcards weren't the only avenue for rally attendees to contact lawmakers. Volunteers stood around the park holding large poster boards adorned with pictures of state senators, their names, and office phone numbers. Close by were other posters with suggested talking points for those who chose to make the call.
Hello, this message is for Senator Shelley Hughes. My name is Deborah Pierce. I'm an educator with Anchorage School District. I'm calling to let you know that we will not tolerate cuts to public education, and we would like you to create fiscal certainty with long-term fiscal plan, and we definitely support broad-based funding for our public education and our kids. Thank you very much.
Deborah Pierce is an assistant principal at Mirror Lake Middle School in Chugiak. This is her fourth year with the Anchorage School District, and she says she's been displaced twice in that time. She says it's been unsettling, and it's a disruption to her family, other educators, and, of course, the students.
It's heartbreaking that every year there seems to be this happening in April and May, and it's a shame that, you know, Alaska kids are put through this. I mean, not just speaking as a teacher and as a mom, but, I mean, these kids deserve the best that we can give them. And I don't think that the state is doing that for them.
Camden Galvin is wrapping up his junior year at Stellar Secondary School in Anchorage. Galvin says Stellar has already lost a teacher and could lose more, and extracurricular activities have been cut back as well.
We used to have like a music program that that had a choir that like, but that class was taken away, and then it became a club, but then the club got taken away because just the money isn't there to like support all these things at the school.
He says he's worried that eventually all extracurriculars and electives will be cut and students will only be left with core classes.
It's just like, how much more can we lose at this point? It's terrible.
Dina Mitchell with Great Alaska Schools says the state is in a fortunate position to have the ability to address its fiscal issues, and she claims it can be done without more education cuts.
We need to innovate. We need to expand and diversify our economy. And we do that through education.
To cap off the rally, the crowd joined the band in a sing-along before departing, many with a list of other senators to call.
A simple flag of the last frontier.
In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
Hillcorp operation managers were in Kenai on Friday to speak at an alliance luncheon. Cook Inlet Offshore Operations Manager Stan Golis updated the pro-oil industry group on recent oil and gas leaks. Golis says repairs to a gas pipeline that supplies heat and power to two oil platforms should be complete. That leak was initially stopped in April, but the fix was only temporary. Golis says divers were set to finish installing a permanent clamp on Friday morning.
I'd like to point out that this is really not a corrosion issue. What we believe is actually happening here is there's tidal action that moves this pipe back and forth across the rocky outcrops and essentially wears a hole in the pipeline.
After the meeting, Golis explained that the line will be tested at nearly double its normal operating pressure to detect any leaks. Hillcorp also plans to use what's called a smart pig to further assess the line.
It is basically a tool that will get wall thickness readings and other things that will allow us to accurately assess the condition of the pipeline.
Golis said Hillcorp will continue to assess its infrastructure as it always has. He says it inspects 20% of its oil and gas systems annually. Golis also outlined a new initiative to lay about 3 miles of new pipeline. The $75 million project will connect to the existing pipeline system to carry oil across the inlet instead of tankers. The project will eliminate the need to store oil at the Drift River Terminal near the base of Mount Redoubt. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Canadian invader brings problems for Alaska moose. Now the state wants your help in tracking mule deer.
In the last 10 or 12 years, there's been an increase in the number of animals that have been sighted.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska is one of 5 states with the most insecure food resources in the nation, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. One reason? Only a small percentage of Alaska's food is produced in-state. That's why state and federal officials are trying to get a better idea of how much food Alaskans actually grow. With that goal in mind, the Matanuska Experiment Farm will host a meeting on food security from 1 to 4 p.m. on Wednesday in Palmer. Stephen Brown, a professor of agriculture extension, says anybody interested in food security is invited to attend. Brown says there are many aspects of in-state food production, including hunting and gathering, as well as traditional agriculture, that are unique to Alaska.
We also have a lot of people that are raising food to feed themselves, but don't necessarily consider themselves farmers. These are all things that are not well understood.
The Wednesday meeting is in room 208 of Kurtula Hall at the Matanuska Experiment Farm on South Georgeson Drive. After new federal plans were set in motion last year, old-growth logging in Alaska's national forests is on its way out. Still, the feds have to make some timber sales available in the Tongass, and so the U.S. Forest Service is in the early stages of planning one of its first young-growth sales since the switch, just outside of Ketchikan. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
When I call Mike Salee, he's out on his boat delivering a load of wood.
Hold on a minute. I got my dogs running off here. Look, I'm Nana. Come on.
I tell him I can call him back, but he seems pretty used to multitasking. He's a small mill operator in Ketchikan who deals mostly in dead and down trees. And he owns a homestead on nearby Gravina Island. His neighbors on Gravina are big landowners, like the state, the feds, and the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, plus the university and mental health trust, all of which can sell the trees on their land for profit. In the past, Salee says some of the landowners haven't left Gravina in good shape. He's noticed a tangle of trees still on the ground after logging.
In places that I had been hiking through and hunting for decades was basically turned into like a blowdown.
Which is why Salee says he's not enthusiastic about a road being built by the state on the island, slated to be completed this year. The road could make it easier for more timber sales to pencil out, including one being planned by the U.S. Forest Service. The agency has a new obligation, bringing more young-growth trees from the Tongass to the market. And between the many landowners and the new road, there's a kind of menu, an a la carte of trees.
Access, access, access. Everybody wants to have access to their lands.
That's Buck Lindekugel, a grassroots attorney for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council, or SEAC. His organization petitioned the feds to transition away from old-growth logging in the Tongass. So you'd think he'd consider harvesting the young trees to be a victory. But it's not that simple.
There's some steep slopes in there, so there's real concern. It may not be the best thing to go back onto this land.
Linda Kugel says at the bottom of the slopes are salmon streams, and he worries the proposed logging could damage the area. He thinks the federal agency should learn from its past mistakes and stop clear-cutting.
You know, we think the Forest Service needs to have a lighter touch on these areas, pull out some marketable products, but at the same time, don't unravel the habitat.
This stuff was all clear-cut once before. It needs to be clear-cut again and started all over.
Eric Nichols says he's eyeing the young growth sale for his company, Alcan Forest Products, which specializes in buying timber. And he admits times have been tough for the industry, a death spiral, as he puts it. It's estimated there are only a few hundred timber jobs left in the region. Part of the problem, Nichols says, is there hasn't been a steady supply of trees. So while this young growth sale is relatively small, at least it's something. And if the Forest Service wants a buyer, Nichols thinks there shouldn't be any more limitations.
So if either get it now with these other landlords, or they're not going to be able to get it in the future.
He says the road being built and collaboration is key. And once harvested, a company like Nichols would likely send the young growth to be milled in Asia. Buck Lindekugel from SEAC says he doesn't see the timber industry or the argument over the national forest going away, even with the transition.
But it's not going to be like it was in the past, where timber was first on the Tongass. Those days are over.
Instead, Linda Kugel imagines small mill operators like Mike Salee selling specialty products from salvage logs and more trees left in the ground on places like Gravina Island. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Over the past several years, fishery managers have placed extremely tight harvest restrictions on king salmon fishing in the Yukon River. The hope is that conservation will lead to larger runs. When managers make those decisions, telling fishermen when and where they can fish and what gear they can use, they need to know how those measures affect subsistence harvests. They need samples of the fish. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the state is working with subsistence fishermen in a voluntary program to find out.
Holly Carroll is the person who manages the king salmon run on the Yukon for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Currently, we're restricting fishermen to smaller mesh sizes. We're also reducing the amount of time they can fish. And so it's really important for us to understand what effects those management actions have on the harvest.
Understanding these effects can help guide in-season management decisions, but also refine management in future years. For instance, last year, more males were harvested than females. Also,
we do find that lately they've been using smaller mesh gear, and so they've been harvesting much younger fish, which is what we would expect.
This is the fourth year of the subsistence sampling program on the Lower Yukon. Collecting biological samples has several steps. First, the subsistence fishermen
take a fin clip off each fish and we analyze the genetic component of the harvest.
The genes show where the fish hatched and where it was heading.
And the other metrics we get are length and sex.
And also age, which is measured by the number of rings on a fish's scales.
Each fish has to have three scales come off it onto the scale card, and you have to check that scale and make sure it's viable scale.
In all, each sample takes about 5 minutes per fish and is done during processing. The state hopes more data will lead to better management. Training sessions with subsistence fishermen on how to collect the samples are beginning this week in the Lower Yukon villages. Trainers will explain what makes a scale viable and how to deal with the samples. Subsistence fishermen will receive $10 per sample. No personal information about the participants goes to the state, not even names. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The Alaska House has passed a bill banning wolf harvest on a section of state land bordering Denali National Park. HB 105 prohibits wolf hunting and trapping on the park's northeastern edge, where a few Denali wolves are harvested each year. The Alaska Board of Game has refused to reinstate a no-wolf kill area since scrapping a previous buffer zone in 2010. Bill sponsor Representative Andy Josephson of Anchorage told lawmakers before a floor vote on Wednesday, the lack of protection has corresponded with a decline in Denali wolf viewing.
It used to be around 2010 and before, you had a 50% chance
nearly, of seeing a wolf. And that number has fallen to 6%.
Some other lawmakers said the small harvest along the park's northeastern edge is just one factor in a broader decline of Denali National Park wolves. HB 105 narrowly passed the House 22-18 before the regular legislative session ended. Its fate in the Senate is uncertain. Legislators are in Juneau for a special session called by Governor Bill Walker to address state spending and revenue measures.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Early Honors Program at Alaska Pacific University delivers an experiential, individualized, and transformational education to high school seniors across Alaska. Find out more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is asking for the public's help in reporting sightings of mule deer around the interior. The deer isn't indigenous to Alaska, but fish and game experts believe the species has been slowly spreading into the interior from the Yukon Territory. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, those experts are concerned they may be carrying a parasite that could devastate local moose populations.
Fish and Game wants to know about any mule deer sightings around the interior because experts are concerned the animals may be carrying the winter moose tick, which, if it spreads, could decimate the area's moose population.
It sucks their blood and causes them to lose hair because they're very itchy, but it causes, especially young animals, a pretty high death rate over winter.
Dr. Kimberly Beckman is the state's wildlife veterinarian.
So we don't want that to infect our moose population because it would have a negative impact on the numbers of moose that we have.
Beckman says Fish and Game is especially interested in one particular mule deer whose carcass was found earlier this month near the Richardson Highway Bridge over the Chena Flood Control Project floodplain east of Fairbanks. The buck was apparently struck by a vehicle and didn't show any obvious sign of infection due to the ticks. But Beckman says that could be because the animal may have died earlier in the winter before the disease's symptoms typically show up. So they need to know when the deer died.
That would help us decide whether there's any risk that it could have been infected with moose winter tick or not.
Beckman says Fish and Game also wants to hear about any mule deer sightings to track their movements into Alaska. Wildlife experts say mule deer aren't indigenous to Alaska, but they say the deer's been sighted here in the interior every now and then since the 1970s.
In the last 10 or 12 years, there's been an increase in the number of animals that have been sighted.
Mule deer are a cousin to the Sitka black-tailed deer, found mainly in the southeast panhandle. That's the only deer species that's historically been considered indigenous to Alaska. Beckman says the mule deer that have been moving into the interior apparently are coming from the Yukon, and she says that's worrisome.
Just recently, the government in the Yukon had done a study looking at mule deer that were hunted or hit by vehicles near Whitehorse, and they found that more than half of them were infected with this moose winter tick.
The parasites have been devastating moose populations in northern tier states and Canada in recent years, killing up to 70% of the populations in Maine, New Hampshire, and Minnesota. Beckman says anyone who spots a mule deer should contact their local fish and game office. Phone numbers and online contact addresses are available on the Fish and Game website, adfg.alaska.gov. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Restrictions on the ivory industry are multiplying in the U.S., and artists in Alaska are worried strict rules could make their way here. Alaska Native carvers do have a degree of protection under federal law, but non-Native carvers who only work with fossilized ivory are not shielded in the same way. KHNS's Abby Collins reports.
That's the sound of a dental tool. But Bruce Schindler is not a dentist. He's an ivory carver. Schindler hunches over a work table in his sunny Skagway studio. He uses the metal drill-like tool he's adapted for his craft to carve a small piece of fossilized mammoth ivory.
A pair of eyes, kind of unfinished idea.
But the great thing
Schindler came to Skagway in 1993 to drive a tour bus. Soon after, he started working with ivory. The mammoth ivory he restores and carves comes from the Dawson City area in the Yukon.
I go up and I'll drive hundreds of miles of dirt roads going from gold mine to gold mine, searching for miners who are willing to sell some of the tusks they find.
Last year, the Obama administration put an almost complete ban on the commercial trade of African elephant ivory in the U.S. But that ban didn't touch the fossil ivories that Schindler and others in Skagway use. Those are still legal. And Alaska natives are permitted to harvest walrus ivory under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. But some states have gone a step further, implementing tougher restrictions that prohibit the trade of nearly all ivory. Schindler's concern is that a similar ban could come to Alaska and devastate the industry here.
It's not just scary, it's kind of apocalyptic in many ways.
Zach Smith is with the Natural Resources Defense Council. It's one of several groups that have lobbied states to put tougher restrictions on ivory. Smith says they're not going after anything protected under federal law. That includes the walrus ivory that Alaska natives are allowed to harvest. But the fossilized ivory is a different story.
NRDC supports the closure of domestic ivory markets focused on elephant ivory and including ivory markets that offer a cover for elephant ivory for the illegal trade in elephant ivory.
Smith says illegal elephant ivory is often presented as a legal product, so prohibiting the trade of other ivories could help cut back on illegal behavior. And some states agree with that logic. For example, California has set a ban that extends to fossilized ivory. Schindler argues it's easy to tell the difference. Those outside laws are already affecting Alaska carvers. Schindler says he's lost about half of his customers, artists who used to purchase tusks from him for their own work. Locally, Schindler says the market is strong, but there is still uncertainty. Kathy Wassman's family owns a shop called Taya River Arts. Wassman wears ivory jewelry that she carved herself. She says sometimes customers question the ethics of what they're purchasing.
I think it's a teaching moment most of the time. It's the opportunity to let people know that, hey, what you're looking at is unique and it has nothing to do with endangered species.
Schindler says as carvers, they aren't against most of what ivory bans in other states entail, but...
To add Alaskan ivories to this ban is shameful. And it's just misguided.
A resolution was introduced in the Alaska Senate in February that aims at protecting legally acquired walrus, mammoth, and mastodon ivory from current and future laws.
Mammoth ivory is still going to stay the center of what I do, but I'm starting to work gold. Because I have access to gold miners, I'm buying gold from them, so I'm starting to work my own gold jewelry. I want a backup.
In Skagway, I'm Abby Collins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories are at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aaron Bolton in Homer, Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Abby Collins in Skagway, and Josh Edge and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.